You are listening to a message by Pastor David Guzik for Enduring Word. For more information about our ministry, please visit enduringword.com.
Hey everybody, David Guzik here, and very pleased that you could join us finally on another Thursday when we're going to be able to get together and do our YouTube Live question and answer. You know, I had a stretch where it seemed like week after week I was able to do these, and that made me very, very happy. Now I have been a stretch where over the last five Thursdays, I've been unable to do one of these live. The last one we did was I was live in Montreal, actually. And then since then, I've been a lot of places. I've been traveling a bunch, and I just haven't been able to come in and do another YouTube Live. Very happy I could do one today. I want to talk to you more about kind of what's going on and what I've been doing and what's ahead of me. But for right now, let's get right to some questions that have already come in. First of all, Price Servant of Christ asks this question. Here we go. How can one teach a child about who Jesus is or how Jesus is Lord in a way that he or she may understand if her or his friends tell him that Jesus is the Son of God, but not God? Listen, this is a really good question. And as I thought about this question, I thought, this is kind of difficult because we don't know how sophisticated we should be with our children when they're at a young age regarding theology. We don't want to blow their minds. We don't want to speak in a way that's far above them. And so I don't know how much you need to go into the details of the Trinity, that there's one God in three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. I mean, I think that's kind of an age-appropriate kind of understanding. I think the important thing to tell our children is this, is that Jesus, the Jesus of the Bible right here, that Jesus is truly God and truly man. I think that that's something that can't be reinforced enough with our children. So if they have playmates that are kind of telling them, as the question came in, if the playmates are saying, well, Jesus is the Son of God, but not God, our children should be secure enough in understanding, no, the Bible says that Jesus is God. I'm not trying to suggest that necessarily the children get into a debate with their playmates about it. Although, look, if the child knew what they were talking about and God so opened up the door, that could be a wonderful thing. But what I'm really suggesting here is that our children should know for themselves. They should hear repeated to them again and again. Jesus is truly God and truly man. He was really God and really man. That needs to be reinforced, not only for children, but for adults as well. So, Price Servant of Christ, I hope that that helps you a little bit in this. And again, more than anything, just keep reading the Bible, reinforcing the Bible, and letting your children know this is what the Bible teaches about Jesus. And if somebody gives to us a Jesus that isn't brought from the Bible, then it's not the real Jesus, the Jesus that really was. All right, next question come in already for A Witness for Jesus. Hello again. Nice to see you. Glad you could join us. I watched some of your messages on A Planet of the Ages. My question is, does the church participate or are the church participants or partners of the biblical covenants? Some say that the church just receives spiritual blessings, but that the church are not real partners of the covenants. What's your view on how the covenant relates to the New Testament church? All right, here it is. I think this is a great question here because that's something that I have a great deal of interest in. And if you go to the website, enduringword.com, you can see a series that I taught on called God's Plan of the Ages. God helping me, I'm going to write a book on the content of that series because I think it's an important subject. And what that series, God Plan of the Ages, does is one major point of organization is the covenants that God made with man. I really don't spend much time on what's sometimes called the Noahic covenant, the covenant that God made with Noah, though there's something to be said about it. But most importantly, I focus on the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, sometimes called the Sinai covenant, the Davidic covenant, and then the new covenant. Now, your question is the church participants or partners of the biblical covenants? Look, I would just put it to you this way. No, except for the new covenant. The church or God's people are brought into the new covenant. Now, I would say that the new covenant created the church, because what was revealed in the Old Testament again and again was that the Gentiles would be blessed by the new covenant. That was prophesied in the Old Testament. What was not made clear in the Old Testament and only revealed as a mystery in the New Testament was this truth, that Gentiles could come in to the new covenant, could be part of the new covenant without having to be previously part of the old covenant or the Abrahamic covenant. Well, actually, they're spiritually members of the Abrahamic covenant as they come in. But in any regard, I think that's the important way to understand it, that the new covenant, in a sense, created the church, this new body of Jew and Gentile coming together in one group, which had not been known before the new covenant was established. I think one of the reasons why I want to write a book on this, why I think this is worthy of discussion, is I think that there are some different understanding of the covenants out there in the Christian world. I know that many of our Reformed brothers and sisters have an understanding of the covenants that I think isn't helpful. They don't really see much new in the new covenant, and they basically see the new covenant as the Abrahamic covenant, if you want to say 2.0. It's the same thing, just a newer version of it. I disagree with that to a great extent, but it really deserves a bigger treatment than what I can give to you right now. So just simply to say this, a witness for Jesus, the church really was outside of the Abrahamic covenant as it was given back in that day. Spiritually, we're engrafted into it now, but that's kind of a different thing. That's a faith thing. Now, so the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, the Old Covenant or Mosaic covenant, but we do share in and inherit the New Covenant. This is God's great promise to us. All right, continuing on, Neely. Nice to see you, Neely. Neely, we miss these. Hey, I want you to know, Neely, I miss them as well. And I guess I need to look at my calendar and see if I'm going to be able to do this next Thursday. But here's the deal. When I can't do these on a Thursday, to the best of my ability, I'm going to answer questions that come in through email and social media and put it out pre-recorded. Okay, anyway, Neely asks, hi, Pastor. My question is it biblical to believe in generational sin? Didn't God tell Israel that no longer sons will pay for the sins of their fathers, but of their own sins only? Neely, I would say you're mostly right. Listen, there is an amazing passage in Ezekiel chapter 18 where God says, do not say that God has cursed the descendants for the sake of the father's sin, or has cursed the present generation, or no, has cursed the previous generation for the sake of the present generation's sin. And so there's a very real sense in which the power of the new covenant, the power of what Jesus did for us on the cross, breaks any kind of sense of generational sin. Now, I do want to say, though, that I think we can all agree that environmentally speaking, there's a such thing as generational sin. If a young man or woman grows up in a home where there's a lot of sin, a lot of rebellion against God, a lot of dysfunction going on because of that, they are going to suffer from that. Now, it doesn't remove their choice whether or not they want to follow in the same ways, but they will suffer. So the effects of my sin, or your sin for that matter, they may reverberate generationally down through the generations, but God does not hold later generations responsible for the sins of previous generations. And I believe that we can say that any kind of generational thing is broken by the power of Jesus Christ at the cross in his death and resurrection by the power of the new covenant. We do not have to feel that we are cursed by any previous generation's sin. in our lineage, in our ancestry. Great, Neely. Great to hear from you. Jared. Hey, David. Always love your question and answers. I was wondering, when you teach, how do you outline your notes? Jared, that's kind of a funny question. Because what you see at enduringword.com that's presented as Bible commentary, that is essentially my notes, my teaching notes. Now, I don't take exactly what's on there on enduringword.com into the pulpit, though I could. Usually what I'm doing is I'm eliminating things, quotes I'm not going to read, maybe a few ideas I'm not going to pursue. But for the most part, that's how my teaching notes are laid out with what you see on enduringword.com, where, by the way, there's a absolutely free commentary on the entire Bible available for anybody in English, in Spanish, and in increasingly more languages, again, at enduringword.com. But Jared, to answer your question, I call the format that I use an expanded outline. It's not a bare outline just with headings and such, but neither is it a written manuscript. So I am somewhere in between on that. I use what I call an expanded outline. So I hope that's helpful for you. Next question, radically rescued. Hey, brother, my question for you is about Messianic Judaism. I know that many come in from that sect and claim that Paul and Peter walked in obedience to the Torah after conversion. What's your thoughts? Well, that's a little bit of a different question, difficult question to answer. It may very well be that Paul and Peter walked in obedience to the commandments of the Torah after that. When we say Torah, we mean the Mosaic Law, the first five books of Moses. After their commitment, because there were many or mostly things in the Torah that don't contradict, although there were a few things. I'll tell you this. After Jesus Christ came into their lives and they were born again, both Peter and Paul never offered a sacrifice for atonement. They may have been involved in sacrifices for dedication or this or that, but never did they offer a sacrifice of atonement, and that's part of the Mosaic Law. Paul was very strong in the idea that Christians were not bound or obligated to keep the Mosaic Law. Look, I think this is the best way to understand this. If you are a believer and you want to observe aspects of the Mosaic Law, you want to keep the Sabbath as the Jewish people do. You want to eat kosher as the Jewish people do. You want to observe some other ceremonies and customs. Now, as long as we're not talking about sacrifice for sin and all that, of course, which in the modern context, we're not talking about that. If you want to follow those customs, you have complete freedom in Jesus Christ to do so. But don't for a moment think that it makes you any more righteous before God. The ground of your righteousness, Messianic believer, and the ground of my righteousness, Gentile believer, who loves the Jewish people, by the way, the ground of our righteousness is not any of our obedience. The ground of our righteousness is who Jesus is and what he did for us, especially at the cross and the empty tomb. That needs to be really understood. So if a person has an affection for Jewish customs and things like that, fine, that's great. They just shouldn't put themselves in the place of thinking that that makes them more right with God. So I think that's the idea that I'm getting there for you, radically rescued. We don't have firm evidence one way or the other, whether or not Paul or Peter, or at least evidence that I'm aware of, continued keeping the Mosaic Law after their conversions, after they were born again. We do know that in some places they parted with those customs, but they may have been fairly observant Jews. That's how they grew up. That's what they thought was important growing up. Maybe they kept many of those same traditions. A witness for Jesus. By the way, I disagree with replacement theology. I don't deny the land promises to national Israel. Good. I think that those are very clear and emphasized in a very powerful way in the scriptures. I can't wait to watch the rest of this. Great questions from you all. God bless you. That's Pride, Servant of Christ. They had to go. And so they're going to tune in later on. Thank you much. Derek Jensen. Hey, Derek. Nice to talk with you. David, could you briefly cover the dispensations of God of the ages? Blessings, brother. Well, there's a lot of different ways that people organize what they call the dispensations. And what they usually think of is different ways that God has dealt with man. For example, God dealt with man in one way in the Garden of Eden before the fall. Then God dealt with man another way after the fall, but before the flood. Then God dealt with mankind an additional way, a different way, after the flood, but before the establishment of the nation of Israel. Okay, and they go on and on in those divisions. Look, I'll just be honest with you. I'm not so enthusiastic on making those hard and fast divisions. I tend to see it in two ways. I would consider myself a dispensationalist based on one principle. The principle that there is a difference between Israel and the church. In my mind, if somebody truly believes that there's a difference between Israel and the church, that the church is not Israel and Israel is not the church, but there is a valid and real distinction to be made between the church and Israel, if that's you, then you believe in some sense in dispensations. Now, how far those get broken down, I'll just be honest with you. I don't organize my Bible, the flow of biblical history. I don't organize it around dispensations. I organize it around covenants. So this is kind of how I break it up in my mind. You have the first 11 chapters of Genesis. That's kind of its own thing. Then you have the Abrahamic covenant. Then you have the Mosaic covenant, which is sometimes called the Sinai covenant or the Old Covenant. Then you have the Davidic covenant, the covenant God made with David about the coming of the Messiah. Then finally, you have the New Covenant. That's how I organize the flow of biblical history. I don't organize it so much with the idea or the term of dispensations, even though there's some overlap there. But just letting you know, that's how I particularly see things and perceive them. Hey, before I go on to the next question, thank you so much for the people who are clicking on the like button. Look, I feel like I'm secure enough in who I am and in the calling that God's given me that it's not like I'm out there searching people, please like me. But from what I understand, from what people tell me, the more likes and the more subscriptions and the more notifications that people click, the little bell, the more visible these videos are on the YouTube platform. And I just kind of figure, look, if I'm going to do it, I'd like it to be visible more than invisible. Anyway, going on to the next question. Robert asks a question. How do you solve the Eruthpro dilemma without the cop-out, it's his nature? All right. Robert, I'm going to have to plead ignorance here. I'm unfamiliar with the Eruthpro dilemma. Maybe I know it under a different name. So if you could type in the chat window more on that, and if we don't get to it this time, I'll tell you what, we're going to get to it next time in our question and answer time. Adam writes a question. What are your thoughts on Acts 7 and Stephen's vision of Christ standing rather than sitting at the right hand? Daniel 7, Revelations, etc., where we have Christ, the Son of God, Son of Man figure, standing. Well, here's the deal. Adam, I think that there is some significance. In every vision we have of Jesus ascended and enthroned in heaven, he's seated at the right hand of God the Father. Matter of fact, in the book of Hebrews, his seated posture is emphasized. So I think it's significant when Stephen sees him standing at the right hand, as you mentioned there at the very end of Acts chapter 7. And of course, we're not given a specific explanation as for why Jesus would be standing at that occasion instead of sitting. The best explanation we can give is to simply say that Jesus was standing in honor of the first martyr of the church and to welcome in, to recognize and to welcome in this first martyr of the church. That's the best answer I can give, and to me, that makes sense. So thank you for that question, Adam. Sherry, are you just coming on or are you fixing to go off? Sherry, here's my plan. I'm going to stay on another 10 minutes until the bottom of the hour. I wish I could stay on longer, but I got to catch a plane. Today, I'm flying off to Florida to be a part of something that we call Expositors Collective, where it's a very special seminar where I and some other pastors that I know and respect, we get together with young people in small interactive groups, and we teach them how to be better expositors, verse-by-verse teachers of the Bible than they were before. So I'll be on here another 10 minutes until 12:30 Pacific time. Isaac. Hey, Isaac, nice to speak with you. Do you think Lucifer fell in eternity past or after the creation of man? Do you have a firm opinion on either or even neither of them? Good to see you. And by the way, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to you, Isaac. Nice to speak with you. Hey, I believe that, let's just measure this. It can't be proven one way or the other. But I believe, and again, I don't hold tight to this belief because it can't be proven. So I believe it, but I hold it fairly loosely. I believe that Lucifer rebelled sometime after God proposed, if you want to call to the heavenly councils, he proposed the creation of man. Now, whether or not that was actually before man was created or not, I don't know. But there are some Jewish rabbinical legends. And again, I want to stress they're just legends. We don't take this as scripture, but I just find it as interesting, something I can hold on to loosely, but I don't hold on to it tightly. But there's Jewish rabbinical legends that argue that the reason why Lucifer fell was because he didn't like the idea of man being created and this being who would be created in the image of God, which I believe not even angels or angelic beings are created in God's image. So I would believe it would be at least after it was known among angelic observers that mankind would be created. Again, that's kind of in my God's Plan of the Ages series, and hopefully before too long, it'll be in a book. God bless you, Isaac. Anthony. Hey, Anthony, great to see you. Glad you could tune in. Do you think the disciples had their suspicions of Judas? Anthony, that's a great question. Were the disciples suspicious that Judas would betray Jesus? And I want you to give the answer that I would come up with. I would say no. And this is why I would say no. I don't believe the disciples were suspicious because, do you remember at the Last Supper when Jesus told his disciples, one of you is going to betray me? The disciples did not say, it's Judas, isn't it? I knew it was him all along. The disciples do not say that. What do the disciples say? The disciples instead say this, Lord, is it I? And it seemed like the disciples were in general agreement with the idea that Judas should hold on to the money that the disciples held in common. You know, these things just kind of lead us to believe that they did not have suspicions of Judas before the fact. Great question, though, Anthony. The Molters. Hey, nice to see you again. In Genesis 18, chapter 14, the Lord told Abraham, I will return to you at the appointed time next year. Sarah will have a son. Did the Lord return the next year? Could this refer to the miracle of birth? Yes, it refers to the miracle of birth. It doesn't refer to God returning in... Now, we have to say, in Genesis chapter 18, this is the meeting where God as far as we can tell, appears to Abraham in human form. And anytime we see that on the pages of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, we think that is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. Because no one's seen the Father at any time. If God is revealed in any kind of material human form, it's probably a preview appearance of Jesus. So it does not seem that when later Sarah became pregnant and had this child, that the Lord appeared personally. Rather, he visited her with the blessing of a miraculous pregnancy, with the ability to conceive miraculously. That was the visitation, not the Lord's physical presence. Hope that's clear enough for you. Robert, the erythro dilemma is by Plato, quote, thank you for clarifying this for me, Robert. What is morally good commanded by God because it is morally good, or is it morally good because it is commanded by God? Oh, Robert. That is a tremendous question. And it's interesting that you'd bring that up, because I was just talking to my son about this very issue. We didn't use the term, the erythro dilemma. We were talking about this very issue just this previous week. Because the idea is, again, I'll just repeat your words. Is something good because God commands it? Or does God command it because it is good? And the reason why this is such an interesting philosophical dilemma is simply this. If God commands something because it is good, does it mean that there is something higher than God in moral principle or nature? Something that even if God were to disobey, that would be wrong. Robert, I'm going to tell you, as someone who hasn't thought through this very much, I'll be honest with you. Even though, like I said, we had a fascinating discussion on this just this last week. My inclination is to say, put more emphasis on the idea, even though, listen, I understand there's some dilemmas involved in this. But I'm just being straightforward with you. My inclination is to put the emphasis on the idea that God commands things because they are good. That there is a transcendent goodness that even God conforms to in goodness. And I'll tell you why, because I'm not worried about this setting up something higher than God, because God is a person. And there is no person higher than God. There is no being higher than God. But I don't want to fall into the trap of just kind of saying might makes right. And theoretically, evil would be good if God did it. No, I think that God even conforms and even is consistent with these principles of good. But I'm the first one to admit with you, this is a complicated philosophical discussion. There's quicksand on many sides. I'm sure in some ways I just stepped into some quicksand. But it's something fascinating to talk about from a philosophical perspective. Thanks for the question, Robert. Couple more questions before we go on here. Sherry, do you have an address where I can write to you? Sherry, you'll find that on our website. Go to the contact page of the website or email me. You can email me from the address you'll find at enduringword.com. Go to enduringword.com, click on the about or the contact. You'll find out how to contact me, and I'd be happy to hear from you. And, Robert, it's Euthypro. Okay, thanks. I'm going to work on that pronunciation. And then final, last question of the day goes to Sean. Sean, nice to hear from you. James says that we should be careful not to teach because of a stricter judgment. Does that only apply to this life, or will teachers be punished in heaven? Well, all right, great question, Sean. We need to take serious this idea that the Bible says that teachers will be liable to a stricter judgment. However, I don't see that stricter judgment in terms of punishment in heaven, but it could be the denial of reward in heaven. Now, if somebody regards that as a punishment, then let them regard it as a punishment. But that's more fundamentally how I see it. Not so much as a punishment in heaven. We're not going to be punished in heaven for anything. Heaven's heaven. But reward may be denied, and we may find that things that we did on earth that we thought would gain much reward before the Lord end up gaining no reward before the Lord. And we are saved, as the Bible uses the expression, by the skin of our teeth. So stricter judgment, yes, in this world, also in the world beyond, but I don't look at it in terms of judgment, more as denial of reward. Hope that's helpful for you. And I've so enjoyed our time together. I can't tell you for sure whether or not I will be able to do this next Thursday. If I can't, then we're going to do a recorded version. But after next Thursday, I think I'm around a lot on Thursday afternoons, and we can do a lot more of these. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for all those who support the work of Enduring Word. Right now, I'm off to Florida for a trip. But I do want to say this. If you go to enduringword.com right now, and today's date is November 29th, now and for about another week, you're going to see a pop-up that comes up on the website when you go to it. And the pop-up is just to remind people about our year-end giving donation campaign. I just want you to know this about that pop-up. Number one, if you say no to it, it shouldn't come up again. But then number two, the pop-up is only going to run for a couple weeks. Look, a few times out of the year, we don't mind reminding people that we're supported by your donations. We don't want to put it in your face all the time, but a couple times a year for a couple weeks at a time, we don't mind doing that. Again, that's at enduringword.com. And I'm sending out a mailing to everybody on our email list about just some of the most wonderful, exciting news I got from a pastor in Cambodia who uses the Enduring Word commentary. Look for that on the email thing. Sign up on the email list. Go to enduringword.com and do that. Otherwise, thank you so much for tuning in, and I look forward to when we can be together the next time. God bless you.
You've been listening to a message by Pastor David Guzik for Enduring Word. For more information about our ministry and how to grow in your relationship with Jesus, please visit enduringword.com.